You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll dig into some country music and take a look at some of the nominations for the Academy of Country Music Awards this weekend. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is defending his choice to accept a free trip to London last year with lobbyists. A student is suing Marcus Ann High School for banning his shirts depicting firearms. And near Adele, a cheesemaker is getting back in business to help save four local dairy farms. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Rob, first, a quick check-in on a story we talked about last week in the roundup on Representative Dale Coinga removing a sign in the Capitol, ordered now to pay $30,000 in compensation after taking that down. What is the latest in that story?
Right. So the latest is Coinga says that with the help of friends and family, he will reimburse the state. The state is on the hook for the $30,000 in the settlement after he took down a sign that was allowed to be in the state capitol. And so it's a little bit not clear what exactly that means. Does that mean campaign funds? Who are his friends? Also important to say he hasn't actually paid the money yet, but still, I mean, that is the development that he says he'll not have the taxpayers be on the hook, that he'll be on the hook, or at least people he knows.
And then turning to some new news, Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, first of all, is in the news for one thing he's not going to do. He says he's not going to run to replace Congressman Paul Ryan in the 1st District. People were looking at him as maybe the most prominent possible candidate, especially after Reince Priebus said he's not going to do it.
Right, yeah. I mean, it feels like a bit of a scramble. There's been a handful of possible candidates in that Republican candidates in that district who in the last couple days have declined, so that they won't run. Voss is he's the Assembly Speaker in Wisconsin. He's just basically the state version of Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and he's out for that race.
And he's also in the news. He's getting attention for this trip to London he took last August with lobbyists and other lawmakers. Talk about this trip and why it's in the news, Rob.
Right. Well, it's tied to this this guy who's the Speaker of the House in Ohio, the state legislature in Ohio, named Cliff Rosenberger, who this week resigned from his office. He's in the middle of a giant FBI investigation of corruption in office. Now, Rosenberger's thing appears to be pretty sweeping. It involves a luxury condo, a bunch of fancy trips, and we certainly don't see anything quite so far-reaching in Voss's case. But he did go on a trip with the guy, and he went on one of these sort of funded by a conservative group trip to London with a bunch of lobbyists who have interests in swaying him on Wisconsin laws.
And this is something that lawmakers do. They can accept funding for trips from organizations, neutral or sort of partisan-leaning organizations. They do this fairly often. There are rules about what they can and can't do. It sounds like this Ohio guy definitely took it further with accepting the donation of the use of condos and things like that.
Right. It sure looks like it. Right. And I do think like that distinction is important. But it is also a case where even if the trip was legal, it's still reasonable to ask whether it's a good way of serving the public. And we should say exactly what has come out, which is the lobbyists involved in this case were representing these title loan companies, these sort of extremely high interest short term loans that are, as a business model, designed to, rely on, prey on poor or desperate people who can borrow money by using their car as collateral. So Voss has been a direct advocate of loosening regulations on those companies in Wisconsin. Those lobbyists have been donors to Republican campaigns and to Voss specifically. And so, right, there are disclosure forms. There are reasons even why we would want our elected officials to be able to do some travel, attend conferences, learn, you know, do educational travel or whatever. But I mean, it still, it raises a question of whether this is like really an appropriate case of that.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. Here's a school story, Rob, that's getting attention. A student at Markazan High School is suing the school over their response to a few of his T-shirts that featured images of firearms. Tell us more.
Yeah, his name is Matthew Shaneker, and he is apparently he is an enthusiast for both the Second Amendment and the First Amendment. He wore a couple of shirts that he would wear to school. His family says has been wearing all this school year, but which his principal, his teachers, took issue with in recent weeks, I guess, as the debate around around gun control and gun rights has escalated. So he has a shirt that says "Celebrate Diversity," and it shows a bunch of different guns, which is one form of diversity. He has a shirt that says "Love," that is the letters are all spelled out with weapons. So, you know, pretty clearly these shirts are meant to be a way of mocking, like, liberal messages of tolerance or whatever. So, you know, he argues that this is political speech and that it should be allowed in the school.
And he's backed in this lawsuit by Wisconsin Carry, a firearms advocacy group. What argument have they been making in this case?
Well, I mean, so the basic argument is that that the district is violating his First Amendment rights, right? And there's no like set policy. This is one point that is raised in the lawsuit, is that it's like a case by case basis. So the principal can just sort of decide, I don't like your shirt, so you have to either turn it inside out or else go and sit in this cubicle for your school day. And so, you know, it's not in response to a policy. They also say that it's not in response to any sort of threat to the educational environment. And, you know, there is, we'll see. It will be interesting to see where this goes. But there is case law. There's a famous Supreme Court case that was about students in Des Moines, Iowa, who protested the Vietnam War by wearing black armbands, and that was found to be allowed in schools. You can do certain types of political speech within schools. It'll be a bit interesting to see whether this is one of those, or if this crosses a line in some other way.
And finally, Rob, a couple of cheesemakers are deciding to reopen the small Beechwood cheese plant near Adel in Sheboygan County. And this could be big news for a handful of dairy farms in that area. Tell us about that story.
Right. We've talked a few times about these are hard times to be a dairy farmer. Milk prices are very low. There is a ton of milk production happening in places that never used to have milk production, like Texas. There are a lot of Wisconsin dairy farms that are really getting squeezed. So there are these four farms in southeastern Wisconsin, in the Mayville area, that got word just this month that they were being dropped by a company called Westby Cooperative Creamery that had been buying their milk. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this week that this small cheese plant run by a couple of brothers named the Beechwood Cheese Plant, it had been closed for about a year, and the brothers were trying to organize a move. They wanted to move closer to their home in Racine County. And they saw this happening, and they responded, and they're restarting that Beechwood Cheese Plant, kind of a high-end, like, organic cheese plant, and they will buy from and be a lifeline for these four family dairy farms to say that they would absolutely not have been able to find a buyer without this.
Well, watch that story and the wider story of the issues facing dairy farmers in the future. Rob, thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's with us every week to get us up to speed on news from around the state. The Academy of Country Music Awards are happening this Sunday in Las Vegas. Along with the music, country stars will remember the victims of last year's mass shooting at a country music festival in that city. Angela Stefano is the editor-in-chief of TheBoot.com, a website dedicated to country and Americana music. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us, first of all, how these awards differ from some of the other country music award shows in the game.
Yeah, Yeah, so the ACMs are one of the two big country music award shows, the other being the CMAs in November. The ACMs were founded as sort of a West Coast award show to recognize artists like, you know, Glenn Campbell, Merle Haggard back in the 60s. But today, you know, they all pretty much focus on sort of the big top 40 country artists coming out of Nashville.
And before we get to the music, this is the first show there in Las Vegas since the mass shooting at a country music festival. And this, I understand, usually this is a big party atmosphere at this awards show. How are they handling this tragedy?
Yeah, so it's about 6 months since the shooting at Route 91 back in October. You know, everyone we've talked to said they're trying to kind of strike a balance between fun and, you know, remembering the victim, and being reverent of that tragedy. You know they're going to address it during the show on Sunday night. Pretty sure it'll be right off the bat. And then I think, you know, there will be a lot of sort of unscripted sort of things happening there as well. We don't really know any details yet. They've been really quiet about that, but definitely expect something emotional and big.
We'll watch for that. And now let's get into some of the music. And we can't cover all the categories or all the nominees. Let's hit some of the highlights, though. The biggest one, maybe Entertainer of the Year. Who are you watching for in that category, Angela?
Yeah, that category, we're predicting Jason Aldean to win it. First off, he has already won it two times in a row, so this would be a three-peat for him. But also, you know, he was the one on stage at Route 91. We're back in Vegas. It's a very full circle thing. And, you know, definitely it's his to lose, really.
Let's give a listen to Jason Aldean and You Make It Easy.
You took out my rough around the edges. Never let it ruffle up your feathers. Angel. Yeah, I'm down for life. You got me wrapped around your finger and I like it just in case you
And Angela, does this show feature a lot of performances, and are these kind of usually over the top?
Yeah, for sure. You know, Aldean's one of the performers too. He'll probably perform that single. We don't know for sure, but yeah, it's going to be a big, you know, very performance filled few hours there.
And then let's turn to some of the other categories. Who are you picking for Female Vocalist of the Year?
So one of the nominees, Miranda Lambert, has won it a bunch of years in a row, but we're going to go with more of a dark horse and pick Maren Morris, who's one of the newer acts nominated. You know, she's had a huge year, a couple big singles, her first number one single, a huge crossover hit called The Middle with Zedd and Gray, who are both kind of EDM, that sort of artist. So she's really elevated, you know, her profile both in country and outside of it in the last year.
I want to give a listen to Maren Morris and a song we've played here. One of our music critics is a big fan of hers, Stephen Thompson. This is her song, Rich.
If I had a dollar every time that I swore you off, and a 20 every time that I picked up when you called, and a
That's got a good Steve Miller vibe, so she's going to appeal to us here in Wisconsin, Angela. That's the Female Vocalist of the Year. Let's turn to Male Vocalist of the Year.
Yep. We're going with Chris Stapleton for this one. You know, he's the way we always say it is, you know, he's Chris Stapleton. He's got an incredible voice. He's, you know, on the top of his game, three number one albums. You know, he's really the one to beat there.
Let's get a taste of Chris Stapleton and Millionaire.
I got love, enough space. That makes me a millionaire. I got a woman with eyes that shine down deep as a diamond.
And I understand, Angela, Chris Stapleton is kind of doing his own thing, not necessarily connecting to the country music establishment in Nashville, say, he and some other people. Is there this divide between, if we want to call it mainstream country nowadays, and new form of outlaw country?
So a little bit. You know, Stapleton has some connections in that, you know, he was a songwriter for a number of years for some really big, you know, well-known mainstream country names. But his sound definitely trends more toward that old school, you know, the kind of country music that people have wanted to, you know, see come back a little bit more. You know, he trends toward more kind of the Jason Isbell, Sturgill Simpson, a lot of those in the Americana genre, which, you know, you really won't see recognized at shows like the ACMs and the CMAs. A lot of that's because of the voting pool is a lot of the, you know, big record labels and sort of the mainstream media and all of that in town. But also, you know, you do see some of that popping up at the Grammys where country and Americana and those sort of different sounds in the genre kind of all come together. And the Americana genre has the Americana Awards as well in September. So they kind of have their own time for recognition.
We're talking to Angela Stefano, editor-in-chief of TheBoot.com, a website dedicated to country and Americana music. This Sunday, the Academy of Country Music Awards airs coming up Sunday evening, that is. Angela, before we go back to some of the nominees, we've got some people listening out there right now are like, yeah, public radio is talking about country music, and some people who are thinking, country music, I have no idea what's going on there. For that second group, if you wanted to give them a 101 and a little playlist, give them some places to start to say, hey, maybe you are a country music listener, you just don't know it yet.
Well, you know, Stapleton would be a really good one to start with. You know, the thing you see a lot is people go, well, I just don't like the way country sounds. Well, no, you probably do. You just don't really know it because you're hearing sort of some of the poppier side of it, maybe. So people like Chris Stapleton, Jason Isbell, Sturgill Simpson, the guys I just mentioned, Margo Price is fantastic. You know, Brent Cobb, people like that. Or if you really do kind of like, you know, the poppy side of it, we talked about Maren Morris a few seconds ago. You know, she has a big top 40 hit right now with this song called The Middle. You might know Kelsea Ballerini, who's had some airplay on top 40. You know, people like that. So there really is a little bit for everybody, whether, you know, you tend more toward the pop side or more toward the folk side. If you like the rock side, try, you know, somebody like Eric Church, who's got a lot of rock elements to his music and, you know, is just a really solid live performer.
And what about the hipster line where people say, oh, I like the old stuff, not the new commercial stuff? Where do we send them for new stuff?
For them, I would definitely send them to, like I mentioned earlier, Brent Cobb. He's got a new album coming out in a few weeks that is fantastic. You could also check out, for somebody a little more mainstream, Brothers Osborne, who are a duo out of Maryland. They're nominated at the award show, too, for a couple things, and they've got sort of that rocky vibe and, you know, just really, really like the sound that they've got.
All right, let's get back to some of the nominees this weekend. Who is your front runner, Angela, for Song of the Year?
So for that category, we are picking Tin Man by Miranda Lambert. It's a song that she wrote with Jack Ingram, and I apologize, I am completely blanking on the other songwriter's name, but that's off of her album, The Weight of These Wings, which came out in 2016. And it's the first album that she released after her divorce from Blake Shelton, who you might know from The Voice or from country music. So a lot of, you know, kind of rumor stuff was circulating around that album. And, you know, this song is really about heartbreak and sort of channeling that. So, yeah, we're going hard for that one.
Miranda Lambert and Tin Man.
By the way there, Mr. Tin Man. You can have my heart.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, that's real nice, eh? That's good stuff.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, about Miranda, so she's up for that award and a couple others. If she wins even once on Sunday, she's going to be the most awarded ACM winner ever. period, out of anybody. So that's a huge thing.
All right, and then that song of the year, what are you looking at for album of the year?
So album of the year, we're going to pick Thomas Rhett, who's another sort of new guy. He released an album called Life Changes last September. And it's just a good mix of these, you know, solid story songs, some a little bit of 90s country influence, a little bit of kind of pop influence. He loves Bruno Mars. He loves, you know, kind of that pop side of stuff, and he really channels it in his live show, and the album really shows that. And so, you know, this would be his first album of the year win, and, you know, he's got some good competition, but I think he could take it home.
All right, here's a taste of Thomas Rhett from that album, Life Changes.
I remember the day I told my daddy and mama, you're gonna have a grandkid.
Yeah.
From Uganda, that's right, we're adopting, and she is the cutest little girl that you ever seen. Well, I was wrapping my head around being a dad, a big wrench got thrown in the plans we thought we had. Now Lauren's showing, got one on the way, yeah, that's two under two, hey, what can I say?
Okay, that take away the southern accent, that could be a Macklemore song, Angela.
Exactly, yeah, and you know that's clearly ripped straight from the pages of his life. He and his wife adopted a daughter and had a biological child last year too. So, and they're like a big celebrity couple in the country world as well.
And Angela, before we wrap up, you mentioned the live shows. Who are you looking forward to seeing perform at the Academy of Country Music Awards?
Oh, goodness. Tons of collaborations this year. Three, actually, to recognize the 25-year anniversary of three different songs. Toby Keith Should Have Been a Cowboy, Alan Jackson's Chattahoochee, and Reba McEntire's Does He Love You. They're going to be singing those with as duets with three other stars. But also, Carrie Underwood's going to debut a new single she just released this week. So that's going to be a really big one. You know, Miranda Lambert's performing, this country quartet, Little Big Town's performing, a new trio called Midland.
A lot going on. Thanks to Angela Stefano, editor-in-chief of TheBoot.com, talking about country music and the Academy of Country Music Awards on Sunday. This is Central Time. Now, there's been a lot of news about lead exposure coming out of Milwaukee recently. Earlier this year, it was reported that the city's health department failed to provide services to thousands of children with elevated blood lead levels. That news led to the resignation of Health Commissioner Bevin Baker in the city. Now, a new lawsuit is alleging that lead paint manufacturers are trying to avoid tens of millions of dollars in settlements by shifting blame to lead water pipes. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett announced the suit this week.
It's troubling to me that lawyers defending the lead paint industry appear to be using public concern about lead and water to confuse the public and the courts.
We'll take a wider look at the issues of lead contamination now. Sherry Johnson is the director of the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison. Sherry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Kevin Engstrom is director of environmental health at 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee. Kevin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Sherry, let's look at long-term trends when it comes to children with elevated blood lead levels. What are we seeing nationwide and here in Wisconsin over time?
Right. So over time, we have seen a decline in the number of children with elevated blood lead levels, and that's largely due to significant policy interventions as well as clinical interventions. So that's the good news. And yet we know that there are still many, many children who have elevated blood lead levels, and that those blood lead levels are related to difficulties that they will experience in behavior and development and academic performance. So it's critical that we focus on primary prevention, which really means getting lead out of the environment and preventing children, every child, from being exposed to lead.
And Kevin, how bad is the problem now in Milwaukee specifically?
Well, 16th Street operates primarily on the south side of Milwaukee, and what we're seeing is prevalence rates that mirror very much what Sherry mentioned, the decline over the last 20 years, and we're seeing a kind of a plateauing. So the prevalence rate is really has stayed at the same level within our program over the last 5 years or so. So I do think that we're in a position where as a city and within our program, we really want to look at some creative solutions to keep driving that prevalence rate down to 0%.
Yeah, Kevin, as I understand it, things are improving in Milwaukee as they are elsewhere, but Milwaukee sees higher rates of elevated lead levels than other parts of the state and the country, right?
Definitely. There are a couple other counties within the state that are hotspots as well, but Milwaukee is definitely, if you look at the prevalence rate and then the actual, definitely the numbers of children that are poisoned, definitely dwarfs any other geography in the state.
And Sherry, you mentioned the consequences of lead contamination, lead poisoning. Can you talk about some of the health concerns that exposure to lead raises?
Right. So I'm a clinical child psychologist and I've worked in pediatric primary care for a long time. And what we see is children who present with difficulties learning in school, different difficulties with maintaining behavioral control, difficulties with making academic progress. So, for instance, there are published studies that show that lead exposure is related to performance on educational proficiency tests, and that data comes straight out of Milwaukee through the Wisconsin Knowledge and Concepts exam. So there are real significant consequences to both short-term and lifelong health impacts, because we know also that when children don't make the educational achievements that they could have made if they hadn't been poisoned, that has impacts for employability as adults and income as adults and the ability to really reach their highest potential.
And Kevin, do you see these concerns in the neighborhoods you work in when it comes to these educational achievement issues related to lead?
Absolutely. I'm a former educator before I joined 16th Street. And so I have students that, even though I did not know at the time whether they had been lead poisoned or not, students that I can remember having in the classroom that I'm fairly certain that was at least part of their struggles that they're having in the classroom. And I think that is one of the potential future solutions that we could look at and really close the information gap between the health community, health providers, and the education systems, and really give some early interventions to students that have had lead poisoning as younger children. As they start into school, we could put some early interventions in place before they're struggling and are on a more negative path.
We're talking to Kevin Engstrom from 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee and Sherry Johnson from the UW-Madison's Population Health Institute, looking at the causes and consequences of lead exposure. Sherry, you mentioned earlier that a key here is prevention. As I understand the science, once the lead is there, once a child has taken that lead in, it doesn't really go away. There's not a cure to get the lead back out. Is that right?
That's correct. There's no cure, and what we also know is that lead accumulates in the body over time, so pregnant women also can release lead that was accumulated in the body to the child that they are carrying. So this is a really significant problem, but it's also preventable. So this notion of primary prevention, getting lead out of the environment in the first place, is really the key to preventing the health problems that we see over the life course.
So how, Sherry, do we do that? What are the prevention techniques to make sure that kids aren't exposed to that lead?
Right. So there are multiple attempts, and Kevin and I work together with a number of other organizations, including Walnut Way and the Milwaukee County Extension and the Milwaukee Health Department Laboratory, with neighbors in two parts of Milwaukee who are interested in backyard gardening, and understanding that soils in many urban backyards have been contaminated with lead from flaking and scraped lead-based paint on the exterior of homes. So there's exposure pathways through soil, there's exposure pathways through lead-based paint, there's exposure pathways through water, there are exposure pathways through pottery from other countries. So there are multiple ways that children get exposed, and I think our challenge as a community is to say, let's work across all of these exposure pathways to really prevent exposure from happening.
And then, Kevin, take us into the neighborhoods you're working in. What kind of prevention efforts are going on?
16th Street operates a lead outreach program that is able to respond to lead tests that are done within 16th Street Community Health Centers. So in 2017, we conducted over 8,000 lead tests that resulted in over 500 home visits. So what we're doing is able to go into the home, look and see what the danger is, and address that on spot with what are called interim controls. So that is generally looking at lead paint hazards in the home and putting in just very simple, basic barriers. So duct tape, cardboard. We utilize a HEPA vacuum to be able to suck up lead paint chips, and just the bare minimum to make sure that that family is protected, at least in the short term. We then, within the home visit, also will distribute water filters that are purchased, and we work in conjunction with the health department in order to distribute those to families that have lead service laterals. Then, as Sherry mentioned, we're part of the Growing Healthy Soils Project, so we have dozens of homes that we've been able to do soil interventions to, so adding compost and adding other elements that are able to reduce the bioavailability of the lead in the soil. And so we feel good about the fact that we have this multi-pronged approach, and yet we're still seeing those prevalence rates come up in the test. So we're responding well, we feel like, to the elevated levels that we're seeing. What we would like to see, as Sherry pointed out, is more primary prevention, where we're just seeing less children. So I think in orientation towards that approach, where being proactive rather than reactive is where I would love to see the city get to, and love to see our program get to as well.
We're talking about lead poisoning and public health in Wisconsin. Sherry Johnson is with us, director of the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison, and Kevin Engstrom with us, director of environmental health at 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered these concerns in your community, maybe in your home, when it comes to lead exposure from, say, paint or drinking water? Do you have questions about how this works, how to prevent it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about lead poisoning and public health in Wisconsin with Sherry Johnson, public health expert from the Population Health Institute. Also with us, Kevin Engstrom, with Director of Environmental Health at 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been an issue for you? Has your child tested positive for elevated blood lead levels? Are you in a community that's seen a lot of lead exposure? Do you want to see a bigger effort to get rid of lead, maybe in your own neighborhood? Or do you have questions for our guests? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Before we go to our callers, Sherry, this debate, this lawsuit in Milwaukee, people are arguing over, is water main exposure or paint the bigger problem? I know they're both concerns. Has one cause been a bigger problem historically than the other?
So I think we should avoid either-or arguments and really focus on the prize, which is getting lead out of the environment and making sure that we're focusing on children that are the most at risk and who have yet to have the attention that they deserve to get a healthy start to life. So the Pew Charitable Trust has published really good information on the multiple exposure risks and the way in which investing in removing lead from the environment through multiple pathways is going to have long-term returns on investment. And I really hope that we can start to really think more long-term about what a society would look like if we invested in prevention now, and how that would really benefit all of us.
Kevin, you get a sense of urgency, say, from city, state officials, the society in general. Are we taking this issue seriously enough?
I think that there's a lot of interest in it, and there's a lot of anger within the community, definitely, but will that anger be able to be leveraged into resources and really having effective programs to address the multiple pathways that Sherry was referencing? I think we'll have to wait and see, but I think the focus on childhood-led poisoning really, I think that accelerated after Flint, I think is promising, and the amount of organizing and interest in this is, I think, a really positive step. I think we're at a really important point now to take that interest and take that energy and really coalesce and get behind some initiatives that we can really put some resources behind and really shift and get that prevalence rate down to zero.
Let's bring on a caller now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Yeah, my question is this. Outside of the Milwaukee metropolitan area, how big is the lead problem? Is this a problem, say, in Madison, Janesville, Superior, Wausau? I'll take comments off the air. Thanks.
Yes, Sherry, do we see problems with lead elsewhere in Wisconsin outside of the Milwaukee area?
Yes, so the State Department of Health Services Division of Public Health is responsible for statewide surveillance of lead exposure. And so you can look at their maps to see that there are, as Kevin reported about Milwaukee, hot spots around the state that are related to things like older housing stock as well as contamination from industry. And so it's certainly not a Milwaukee problem alone, it does affect lower-income children at higher rates than other groups of children, and that's related in large part to the opportunities to keep the housing stock in good repair. And so there are ways in which we need to pay special attention to children that are living in lower-income communities or in lower-income families. Thanks. Around the state.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jonathan in Sharon. Jonathan, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jonathan?
Yeah, what I wanted to bring up is, we use charcoal for water filters. I personally use a form of charcoal called biochar for my garden. And I was wondering if there's been any research done into, because Sherry had mentioned that once the lead gets into the child's system, that it's really hard to get out. Has there been any research done into ingesting charcoal as a means to remove it from the body?
I see, not a filter. Sherry, have you heard of anything like that? As far as I know, right now we don't have a way to get the lead back out once it's in us.
Right. Well, there's a medical procedure that children undergo when the lead levels are very high. I believe it's 80 or above, and that's called chelation, and that's done by a medical doctor in a hospital setting. I am not aware of any approaches that one might do at home or in the community that involve ingesting charcoal, but Kevin may know.
And briefly, though, Kevin, as we wrap up, I want to ask, do you feel a sense of optimism that we're going to make headway in the next few years?
I do. As I mentioned earlier, I think the amount of interest and the amount of energy that is being given this issue, I do feel like we're in a, even though the prevalence rates are the same, I feel like we're in a better place as far as taking a next step towards putting some solutions in place. So I am optimistic, but that optimism really needs to come with hard work as well.
Thanks to both of our guests today. We've been talking to Sherry Johnson, director of the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison, and Kevin Engstrom, director of environmental health at 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee, talking about concerns about lead contamination in Milwaukee and elsewhere. The newly closed We Energies coal-fired power plant in Kenosha County is one of more than 200 coal plants to have shut down in recent years or be slated for closing, but the company still operates Wisconsin's largest coal-fired burner in nearby Oak Creek. Neighbors upset about coal dust from the facility want that plant turned off too or switched to cleaner fuel. They fear the dust problem will get worse. Instead, Chuck Kornbach reports that We Energies is promising other changes.
The Oak Creek Generating Facility is actually two power plants, including one added in a major expansion about a decade ago. They roar 24/7 along the Lake Michigan shoreline. To keep this massive place running, it takes about 12,000 tons of coal a day. For years, neighbors to the south of the plant have complained about dust blowing from coal piles and trainloads of coal. Lately, some folks in a neighborhood to the north have said they're affected too.
It's in and on my air conditioner. That's from almost 2 weeks ago.
Michelle Jeske offers a brief tour of her backyard, pointing at objects thinly coated with black dust.
That's a cooler that was left outside. So some residue, obviously, on the whites, you can see it. Doesn't really just wash off.
Jeske says with four kids going in and out, she also has trouble keeping the dust out of her house. Across the street, the Millard family shows other items, like pans of water set out in the front yard. They're covered in black dust, and Greg Millard says tests have shown it's coal.
In our yard and Michelle's yard, too. It's all over, 200 homes.
Greg's wife, Sheila Millard, says the coal dust is ruining a good community.
The neighborhood has been fine. I don't think our We Energy neighbor has been a good neighbor at this point.
The Millards have lived about a mile from the plant for 11 years. They say the dust problem only got very bad last summer when the power company moved a coal pile closer to their home. The Millards say since then, on many windy days, the neighborhood gets a cloud of dust. The Clean Power Coalition of Southeast Wisconsin, which includes the Sierra Club, faith groups, and others, has highlighted the concerns at two community meetings in Oak Creek. At the first event, local Dr. Michael Gans said there's a good chance that extended exposure to coal dust has contributed to the dozens of cases of asthma and other breathing problems that he's treated.
The coal dust that I believe is likely playing a strong relationship between these folks getting sick very often and actually having coal in their homes.
At a second meeting last week, executives of three companies that own the Oak Creek Power Plant, We Energies, Madison Gas and Electric, and Wisconsin Public Power Incorporated, also attended. They heard pleas to buy out more neighboring landowners or make more use of renewable energy like solar and wind and convert the coal-fired power plant at Oak Creek to cleaner-burning natural gas. Tom Metcalf of We Energies began his response by apologizing.
First of all, I am very sorry for the incidents that have caused us to be here this evening. We can and we must do a better job.
Metcalf and other executives announced that Oak Creek employees will curtail or stop work on outdoor coal piles during windy days. The new coal pile will be lowered and covered with a temporary sealant. Possibly the company will build a new wind barrier. More plant neighbors will be offered tours and encouraged to ask questions. The promises did not impress neighbor Rudy Wendt.
You want to be good neighbors, you say? I don't think so. You just want to pull in that mighty dollar.
Some of the neighbors also say now that We Energies has closed its Pleasant Prairie facility, the company will make more use of the Oak Creek plant, especially when the planned Foxconn factory begins operating 10 miles away. The power company says not so. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, Congress passed changes to the tax code. We want to know if you're seeing the difference in your paycheck or your business. According to road safety research, we're texting while driving more than we used to. We'll find out why laws targeting distracted driving just don't seem to be helping. That plus humorist David Sedaris joins us coming up Monday on Central Time.